History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. When you think about a criminal couple during the Roaring Twenties or the Great Depression, you imagine the chick flapper holding a Tommy gun in one hand and a cigarette holder in the other, and she's standing to the right of her husband, who's wearing a pinstripe zoot suit. The most famous archetype of this couple is Bonnie and Clyde, but before them, there was another criminal couple that actually created this image, and they captured America's attention. They were Margaret and Richard Whitmore, and they made tabloids across the country as Tiger Girl and the Candy Kid during the 1920s. They stole millions of dollars worth of diamonds and precious gems, and they also stole the hearts of America's tabloids and thousands of other Americans. Today I'm speaking with Glenn Stout. He's the author of the book Tiger Girl and the Candy Kid. His book is set during the Roaring Twenties, when some people were becoming incredibly wealthy. There was lots of excitement and cabarets, but many poor people were left on the outside looking in, and many people across society had no respect for authority figures. They thought that all policemen were on the doll. Gangsters were giving them money so they could ignore their speakeasies and their bootlegging. So if you had to rob other people and even kill a few security guards, there were many people who didn't mind that. Well, Margaret and Richard Whitmore were two love-struck working-class kids from Baltimore who tried to reach for a dream of a better life. They stopped at nothing to get rich and headed up a gang that in less than a year stole over $1 million worth of diamonds and precious gems. Along the way, Richard killed at least three men until prosecutors managed a conviction. As tabloids across the country looked into the details of the couple's star-crossed romance, they became heroes to a new generation of young Americans who sought their own version of freedom. We're going to be getting into their story and looking how they went from rags to riches, why some criminals are celebrated by society as sort of a Robin Hood and other people are despised, and what it says about our own culture and how the criminals we celebrate are really mirror image of the flaws that we have in our society. Plus, we're going to get way into the details of how the Whitmores cased jewelry stores, how they were able to rob them and get away with it, and all the things that make true crime so fun to get into, because you have the vicarious pleasure of looking over someone's shoulder as they're participating in a crime without actually risking getting yourself thrown into prison. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Glenn Stout. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Scott.
This is a very interesting topic. This is a great period in history that a lot of people know a bit about, at least by cultural osmosis through popular media, through Bonnie and Clyde and others. But I've never heard of the Whittemores. When did you first hear about Margaret and Richard Whittemore?
I first heard about them almost 15 years ago when I was researching a book I did on Gertrude Ederle, the first woman to swim the English Channel. And I kept coming across headlines about Tiger Girl and the Candy Kid. And I was very intrigued by them. I'd never heard of these two people, yet for about 4 or 5 months in 1926, they were in every newspaper I looked at, including the New York Times, where they were on the front page over 40 times. So I decided I need to find out who these people are, and I started poking around at the story then.
Okay. Well, before we get specifically into their story, I'd like to know about crime in the 1920s. What sort of high-profile crimes were committed? And these crimes were committed for some reason, but why were these kind of crimes committed? And did most people get away with them? Or like today's bank robbers, were they quickly caught after they fled the premises?
Well, it was very much a lawless era because of Prohibition, which left society kind of looking askance at law enforcement, because law enforcement was looking the other way during Prohibition, where everybody was running liquor and opening speakeasies and violating the law in all sorts of ways. The Whittemores kind of rode on the back of Prohibition a little bit, although they didn't participate directly, you know, in the selling of liquor or anything like that. But it was an era of excess. There was a lot of cash flowing around. You know, the liquor business was a cash business. People were still paid in cash rather than by checks, so banks were full of cash, and everybody who was making a fortune in Prohibition was spending money like it was water, and they were buying jewelry and furs and new cars and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So the Whittemores and the rest of the gang, including the Kramer brothers, who were jewel thieves from Europe that Richard Whittemore had met in prison, they looked around and saw all this excess and looked in particular at jewelry stores, which, you know, were everywhere, particularly in New York, and at any given time would have hundreds and hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of merchandise in the stores. Yet at the same time, there was very, very little security. And that was the genius of the Whittemore gang, is that they planned their jobs down to the second, and they cased the joints weeks in advance so they would know exactly what the layout of the store was, where the people who were working in the store were. And then they also knew what they had in stock and oftentimes had made arrangements to fence that material before they'd even stolen it. So they kind of took a wide-ranging approach to their jobs. They took care of every contingency. And it was just very difficult for police to figure out who they were, and almost impossible to trace any of the gems once they were stolen, because they'd be taken out of the costume jewelry they were set in, and the raw gems could then be resold and put into other jewelry very, very quickly.
Well, I want to get way into the details of how they would case joints and how they would do robberies, because let's be honest, I mean, true crime, a lot of the fun is vicarious criminal behavior where you get to feel like you're getting involved without actually risking going to prison. So I like it for that reason. I think a lot of other people do too. But first of all, before we get into that, what is the background of Margaret and Richard, and what's their story and what leads them to becoming jewelry thieves?
Sure. They were two working class kids from Baltimore who met while they were in grammar school. And, you know, Richard was sort of a ne'er-do-well. He started out as a truant and then was incarcerated in a variety of juvenile institutions that turned him into a petty criminal and then a real criminal. And Margaret was his longtime girlfriend. Every time he would come back, you know, he was a little older, she was a little older. And after he got out of the Elmira Reformatory, when he was just over the age of 20, he and Margaret hooked up again. You know, they were two kids that were typical of their time, in that they were coming of age in an era that had been marked by World War I, by a pandemic, the Spanish influenza. And then shortly thereafter, there was a brief but very intense economic depression. So there was very little opportunity for them as working class kids. There was no way to get ahead. Yet the world was exploding. Everything had become electrified. People had cars. They had telephones. All of a sudden, you know, there was, you could go out at night. There was fun to be had. And Prohibition was providing the fuel for all that fun. And they kind of looked at each other, and I think they decided, we're going to go for it any way we can. We want that life that we see on the movie screens. We want that life that we see when we peer through the windows of a cabaret and see how the other half lives, how the F. Scott Fitzgeralds and Great Gatsby's lived. That's the life that they wanted. And the easiest way to get that was to start stealing.
How did they start? What were their first few robberies?
Well, initially, Richard Whittemore was more of a petty thief. He headed up a small gang in Baltimore that they did heists of liquor dealers, bars, grocery stores, things like that. But then he was caught, and he was incarcerated in the Maryland State Penitentiary. And that's where he met Leon and Jacob Kramer, these two brothers who were doing a 10-year stint for diamond robbery in Baltimore. They'd been caught. They had been notorious in Europe before they came to the United States. They developed the can opener, which was a way to break into safes without using explosives. Well, as their time to get out started to approach, they got together with Whittemore. They recruited him and decided, you know, if we try to get in with can openers again, everybody's going to know it's us. But we're going to take our knowledge of the jewelry business, our knowledge of how to case jobs, and we're going to pair ourselves with this tough guy, Richard Whittemore. He'll be the heavy. And when we all get out, we're going to go for big scores. Richard had only been after small scores before, so this was a real opportunity for him. And that's how the genesis of that gang started. The one problem was that Richard got out, and then he got arrested again. He got thrown back into prison. So to get out, he had to escape. And in doing so, he killed a guard. But that didn't slow them down. As soon as they were all free, they started planning jobs together. The Kramers would initially case the jewelry stores or the jewel dealers, and Richard Whittemore was the heavy. He would come in with the firepower, and he would run roughshod over the other members of the gang, keep everybody in line.
All right, well, can you walk me through an A to Z of from initial casing to successful escape? Because,
sure.
I mean, I think a lot of people really do underestimate how much planning goes in. You don't just waltz into a random place. That's how you get caught. That's how the dummies get arrested. But the good criminals are much more meticulous. So can you walk through that?
Exactly. Well, the Kramers were a bit of were chameleons. They could fit into the jewelry business, and they didn't stand out. And so what they would do is they insinuated themselves into the New York jewelry industry, into the diamond district, got to know who was who, visited stores, got to know what they had as stock. And then when they would decide that they were going to hit a particular jewelry shop, they would make several forays to the shop, ask to see various merchandise, things like that. They would tend to do so either at the very beginning of the day, when stock was being taken out of a safe and put in cases, or at the end of the day, when stock was being taken from those cases and put in a safe. That way, they got a very, very good idea of what the jeweler had on hand, what he had in finished jewelry, if he was holding raw, uncut diamonds. They could talk the language, they could talk the lingo, and the jewelers felt very comfortable discussing, you know, what they had on hand with them. Then they would also stake out. They'd find out where the cop on the beat was. They'd plot out their escape route by automobile. They would determine how many employees were in the store, how many were in back, how many were out front. They didn't want any surprises. And then they usually did jobs either right when the store opened, before the general public had flooded in, or what they called closing time jobs, right at the end when they were putting the merchandise away. And they would simply walk in, overwhelm them with force, show guns. Often they would tie people up, but the safes would be open. That was the key. In the morning and in the evening, the safes were always open. So they really wouldn't bother with the stock that was left in the cases. They wanted the really expensive merchandise that remained in the safe, and they could get at it because the safe was open. They'd come in a matter of 2, 3, 4 minutes. They'd steal the jewels, steal the diamonds, and then they'd get out. They'd also had it set up ahead of time with a fence. They were very well connected, and they had a particular fence, Joseph Tropp. He knew the diamond industry as well as they did, and often they knew ahead of time almost precisely what they were going to get. And Tropp, at that point, also knew how much he was going to pay for it. So that's something else that differentiated them from other thieves of that time. They didn't have to go looking for a fence. That's often the most dangerous time for a robber, is to where are you going to get rid of these, you know, where are you going to get rid of diamonds, you know? But they already had that figured out with Tropp. So there was no, they didn't take any chances. In fact, when they would meet Tropp ahead of time, they would tear a dollar bill in half. Tropp would keep one half of the dollar bill. The Kramers would keep the other half. And when they would go to meet him, they would slide the halves of the dollar bill underneath the door and match them up so they knew that they were actually dealing with the right person.
Hmm. All right. Well, they have a really good system set up. Now, if you were to do this today, you don't have to do many robberies until you're on the FBI radar. But this is the 1920s, which I don't think it exists. So what happens after they do a robbery? I mean, do they have safe houses? Are they able to mostly remain in New York, or do they have to leave a city after a certain amount of time?
They did a little bit of both. Sometimes after big jobs, they'd take off and go to Cleveland, where they weren't known, where they could live quietly, and where they didn't raise suspicion. But when they were in New York, they lived the high life. They weren't robbing just to take the money and run. They were robbing so they could live a different life than they lived before. So they kept very, very nice apartments or stayed in the best hotels. They ate at the best restaurants. They went to the cabarets every night and spent money like it was water. That's what Richard and Margaret in particular, that's what they wanted. She once said that, you know, well, of course I stuck with him because he promised me, you know, nice things and all these wonderful clothes. That's what she wanted. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to be seen as a big shot. And during that time period in the milieu of the speakeasy, everyone assumed that Richard Whittemore was a bootlegger. And he let them assume that. He went by, you know, a variety of aliases. Nobody really knew who he was, but he had a lot of money, and that opened a lot of doors. That got him the best tables. That introduced him to some of the best people.
It's such a funny period where you're becoming well-known as almost a celebrity, and they assume you're a bootlegger, but then you're also committing crimes where anonymity is number one. I wonder, what did Margaret and Richard look like when they were committing a crime? Because when we're talking about this, we imagine that Richard had his pinstripe zoot suit and Margaret has her furs, and they both have Tommy guns. Richard's holding with two hands. Margaret's holding it up with one hand and has a cigarette holder in the other. This is the image we have. It could be totally wrong, but what are they like when they were actually committing crimes?
They tried to live the high life. I mean, Margaret was much more in the background than Richard was. Her participation in most of the robberies was limited to she might go into a store and check it out and help case it. She wouldn't participate, with one exception, in any of the actual robberies themselves. So she tried to carry herself well. And at one point, she was staying in a hotel and she told everyone that she'd had a theatrical career that she'd given up for her husband, who was independently wealthy. So she was dressing like a woman of means, like a very attractive young woman of means, but like a woman of means. Meanwhile, Richard is getting tailored suits. He's dressing like a Sharpie. He's dressing like a very successful bootlegger. And, you know, they played those roles to the hilt. That's what they wanted out of what they were doing. And it was very, very difficult for the police to identify them at the time. You know, fingerprints were just coming into use, and that was more for identification than as an investigative tool. To determine who a criminal was, you depended on rogues galleries of photographs, Bertillon method of which was a series of measurements of like your arm and the circumference of your head, where you tried to determine who someone was. So it was very, very easy to be anonymous. It was easy to get false identification. It was very, very difficult for the police to determine who you were unless they knew you were a criminal already and recognized you. And the Whittemores in particular really took advantage of that.
Well, this is, if we're following the arc of a Martin Scorsese movie, you have the first act where they're living high on their criminality and, you know, rising to the top. What happens next? Do they go too far? Are they starting to lose their edge? They're living too exuberantly and that hurts their criminal enterprise. What happens after their initial rise?
Yeah, they went a little too far. They committed one really big robbery of a jewelry dealer, the Gudvish brothers, and they were bringing in a consignment of diamonds from Europe, and they knew that they were being kept in a bank, and they knew that every Monday, one of the members of the firm would go to the bank, get the jewels, walk several blocks to their offices, and bring the jewels in for the day. Well, they tracked him, they determined his schedule, and they decided rather than break into the building where they were on the 11th floor, they would take the diamonds on the street. And so the gang set up, they tailed Gudvish and his partner, and they waited until they were in front of a vestibule just about a block away from their offices, and they did a lightning strike. They followed them on the street. A couple of guys were waiting. They got them in front of the vestibule, pushed them into the vestibule, hit them on the head with pistols, grabbed the wallet full of diamonds, and walked away. It took about 10 seconds. That was a huge score. And afterwards, Richard Whittemore, in particular, really started to party. And he went to a place called the Club Chantilly, which was one of the most exclusive cabaret speakeasies in New York, and just spent money like it was water. That got the attention of the police. They wondered, who is this guy? And after staking them out for a while and tailing Whittemore and some other gang members, suddenly one of the police officers said, "I think that's Dick Whittemore. He's wanted for murder in Maryland for the killing of that guard." So over a several-day period, they kept tailing everybody in the gang until they pretty much figured out who they were. And then late one night, Richard Whittemore got drunk in the cabaret. He raced out to get more wine, and the police started tailing him. He realized he was being tailed. There was a screeching car chase through the streets of Midtown Manhattan, and Richard Whittemore was caught. At that time, sort of the jig was up. And John Coughlin, who was the chief inspector for the New York City Police Department at the time, was a master of getting criminals to squeal on each other. He played them off each other. And that's what he did with the Whittemore gang. He would tell some gang members, hey, Richard Whittemore's giving you up. He's throwing you under the bus. Then he'd tell Richard Whittemore, no, these guys are throwing you under the bus. They'd all squeal on each other. In fact, at the beginning, none of them were talking, but eventually they did talk. And then Richard had the master stroke because they'd picked up Margaret and he didn't want Margaret to get arrested. So at that point, he said, I'll confess to everything if you'll let Tiger Girl go. Well, that made them romantic heroes. The tabloids ate it up. And that's when Tiger Girl and the Candy Kid started to become really famous.
This is after he's arrested. That's when they enter the press corps.
Yes, this is after he's arrested. Because until he was arrested, they'd only had an inkling that there was a gang operating that was doing all these jobs. But when they arrested Whittemore, they suddenly realized that, yes, this was the gang we've been looking for. These were the people we've been looking for. And he didn't want Margaret to do time. So he decided he'd talk if they'd let her go. And the tabloids just fell for the romance of that. Here's this tough-talking guy. He's giving it up for the love of his life. And it became a front-page story, coast to coast.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Yeah, and I'd like to talk about why some criminals are beloved by the public and others are hated. So in modern America, if you commit a terrorist attack, then society sort of links arms to find you, or better yet, an Amber Alert, where everyone's phone goes off, there's a child abduction, and everyone wants this person to be caught. Everyone hates this person. No one would be on your side. Anyone would give you up. But then you have other criminals in the past, like John Dillinger, who maybe in the 1930s is seen like a Robin Hood, where banks are despised. They're seen as cleaning people out in the Great Depression. And nobody likes banks. They almost think, okay, this man is robbing them. He's holding them at gunpoint. Okay, we don't like his violence, but he's fighting something. He's fighting a fight that I myself can't fight. So there's a public support of a certain type of criminal. For the Whittemores, now jewelry stores, I don't know if that plays into it all. Is it the romance? Is it the love aspect? Why do you think that they would have, the public would have been interested in them and not the public wouldn't despise them? What kind of makes one despise?
There were a couple of elements involved. One, they were young and they were attractive. And that made it easy for other young people to look at Margaret and Richard and see, you know, that's the kind of life I would like to live. And also in the 1920s, there was not the feeling towards law enforcement and the law that there is today. If you were working class in particular, all that excess was out of reach for you. And, you know, if you had a job, you probably had to work 60 hours a week, and you were probably being screwed by your employer. And they saw somebody like Margaret and Richard who went for it, who didn't play the usual game that society did. You know, they went and they took what they wanted. And I think it surprised the authorities because he went on trial twice, once for a bank robbery murder, and he got off. And this was in Buffalo. And they were stunned at the beginning of the trial when hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young people, flappers and their swains, showed up at the courthouse. And when they'd see Richard Whittemore, they'd cheer for him. They liked the idea that somebody was taking it to the man, that somebody, you know, was taking money and taking it from the rich people and getting it their way and getting away with it. That's what people, you know, fell in love with. And like I said, it really helped that they were young, that they were attractive, that they were having fun. They didn't look miserable. After they were caught, Margaret's still tooling around in an expensive squirrel coat, you know, and she's got platinum rings on. She's wearing pearls, and Richard's still wearing his tailored, you know, zoot suit, his pinstripe suit. They made he looked a little bit like John Garfield. You know, he was very striking, and she was very striking too. And once the romance aspect, you know, clicked in, then it was all over. People just fell for the story of the romance, that here he was falling on his sword to save her.
Right. If they see that, then do the public think, okay, well, he's an honorable thief, and yes, he killed a prison guard, but really, the entire system is so crooked that can you blame a man trying to make his way through life? I'm just guessing what the depiction is.
Oh, that's absolutely right, because the assumption back then was that all the politicians were crooked because they were allowing prohibition to take place, allowing the speakeasies to stay open. The cops were all crooked because everybody knew cops didn't make any money, and most of them were on the take. So there was no, you know, there was no a feeling that the cops were on the right side of the law. The cops were just like the crooks, only they had a badge. And that's how people looked at it back then. There was none of the hero worship that we have today in regard to the authorities. And also the justice system. They saw the justice system as rigged against them. You know, if you were arrested basically for anything, you were probably going to be beaten until you confessed. And then you were going to have a trial that was going to take about 10 minutes. You were hardly going to have any representation. You know, everything was stacked against you from the beginning. And it was thrilling to see somebody like Tiger Girl and the Candy Kid, who seemed, at least for a while, to beat that game.
Well, this is just a quick aside out of the main narrative, but what you're saying is interesting because it sounds like the public at large loathes the police. And in early 2021, we're coming off of a national conversation about the role of policing, where some talk about systemic racism in police and others push back and say, no, back the blue, because they're the last line of defense for public chaos. But do you think someone from the 1920s would be surprised in 2020s that there is such a large block of public support for the police based on how they perceived the police back then?
Oh, I think very much so, because it was one of the things that really surprised me was the degree to which police were disrespected. Prison guards were disrespected. Authorities were disrespected. There was very much an us against them attitude from most members of the public, particularly younger people, who felt that they were wrongly being denied their chance to make it in the world. And you had police guarding money. They weren't helping people. You had, the justice system that was just taking advantage of poor people who didn't have any money. So there was almost a political awareness back then of the disparities in the justice system that today, you know, people are, until somewhat recently, really, I think, haven't been that aware of, at least to the degree to that they were aware then. And once again, you have to factor prohibition into it, where everyone saw that the authorities were, if you had money, they looked one way. And if you didn't have money, they hit you with a billy club.
Right.
And that's how it worked.
So how does the trial proceed? What happens and what's the whole story as this go on? Because this is a big media circus, as you've described.
Right. Well, he first goes on trial in Buffalo for a bank robbery in which two guards were killed. And there was a real battle between the authorities as to whether he would go on trial in New York City, he'd go on trial in Baltimore, or whether he'd go on trial in Buffalo. Buffalo won initially. They thought they had a slam dunk case. But once again, the popularity of Richard Whittemore and Tiger Girl made it not so. He was put on trial. And he was acquitted. The jury just could not come to a verdict. Now, there also might have been some jury intimidation there. There's evidence that took place. Their names and addresses were put in the paper, and there was evidence that they were threatened during the trial, but they let him go. But he didn't get to go free. He was then sent to Baltimore, where he went under trial for the killing of the guard. Now, that was much more of an open and shut case. And the attorney in Baltimore, the state's attorney in Baltimore, did not let a circus take place like they did in Buffalo. In Buffalo, there were thousands of people crowding the courthouse. When Richard Whittemore was set free, he held his hands over his head like a boxer who just won a battle. And had the crowd been able to get to him, they'd have carried him away. That didn't happen in Baltimore. They kept a much tighter lid. They kept the press away from Richard Whittemore. In Buffalo, he was able to hold court before the press almost every day. In Baltimore, they didn't allow that to happen. So they tamped down the public attraction to him as much as they could. And then Richard Whittemore really couldn't get over the scene in the courtroom where the widow of the guard that he killed testified. There was no question that Whittemore had killed the guard, Whittemore tried to argue that he did so in self-defense. But once you saw the widow on the stand talking about her dead husband, when Richard took the stand, the jury simply didn't believe him. He couldn't snow the jury. And when the verdict finally came in, and it was a shotgun trial, it only took a couple of days. But when the jury came in and Whittemore was found guilty, as he was led from the courtroom, chained to the guards, he turned to the prosecutor and he spit in his face.
How did the public perceive this verdict?
He still had his fans in Baltimore. They weren't allowed access to him quite as much, but it did cause a bit of a ruckus in the newspapers, because the Baltimore newspapers were stunned at his popularity. But on the street, he remained very, very popular. And there were still hundreds of people outside the courthouse when he was convicted, and also when he was later then sentenced to hang by the neck. And in fact, as the date of his execution approached and the night of the execution, there were thousands of people outside the Maryland State Penitentiary. It was described as a carnival-like atmosphere. They were selling hot dogs. They were selling soda pop. It was the place to go if you were a young person. This is the best date ever. And they weren't there to celebrate Richard Whittemore's death. They were there to show their support. So even though the newspapers in Baltimore had turned against him, at the public level, people still saw him as somebody who, you know, who was worthy of admiration. It's quite fascinating just to see the degree to which the public fell for this romantic story. Tiger Girl was in the press all the time, pleading his case, talking about how much she loved her husband, how wonderful he was to her, how he couldn't have been, you know, couldn't have done the terrible things they said. And Richard Whittemore pled his case in the newspapers too. He wrote a 15,000-word biography of his life that basically laid the blame at society for taking a truant and turning him into a criminal. People responded to that, because a lot of people a lot of younger people were having a tough time getting by. They were having tough lives, and they identified with that.
I'm curious about Margaret's fate, but first of all, the name Tiger Girl and Candy Kid, how did they get these nicknames?
Sure. When Margaret was first arrested, they were with several gang members when Richard had the smaller gang. And when the police busted in on them, she and another woman passed out the guns to the other gang members. So the police tagged her with the name Tiger Girl, which had been a name that had been used for a number of notorious young women criminals. There was a woman in California who'd killed her mother because she wouldn't let her go dancing. They'd called her a Tiger Girl. And it gave off this veneer of somebody who was both sexy and dangerous, innocent yet cunning. That was Tiger Girl. Candy Kid was slang for somebody who was a smooth talker, and Richard was a smooth talker. He was a bit of a chameleon himself. He could fit in with any group, and people liked him. He was very personable, but it also spoke to the gang's drug use, candy being a euphemism for drugs. Cocaine was quite popular back then, and most of the gang members used cocaine. And then candy was also slang for diamonds. So the Candy Kid fit Richard like a pinstripe suit, and Tiger Girl fit Margaret like that fur coat.
After Richard's hanging, what happened to Margaret?
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, that's a interesting part of the story, because she had been front and center for so long, and then her husband dies, and the funeral, thousands of people showed up on the street outside her mother-in-law's home for the funeral, and hundreds showed up at the cemetery. And at that point, Margaret, I think, had finally sort of had enough of the scrutiny and the popularity, and she sort of withdrew. At first, very slowly, but then much more quickly. And the press more or less left her alone. There were a few rumors that she was going to marry a wealthy man. She was certainly being courted by people. There was some talk that maybe there were still thousands of dollars and stashes of jewels. And perhaps some of these suitors of Margaret thought that there was money there and went after her. But she ended up living a very quiet life. 5 or 6 years later, she married not a very wealthy man, just an older man, but he was a railroad worker. They went back and living in a row house, the same kind of row house she'd grown up in. She had a daughter, and never again did she make the newspapers. In fact, when she ended up dying, which was in 1990, I believe, the newspapers made no mention of her career as part of the Whittemore gang. And in fact, they even misspelled her name. So she just absolutely faded away. And quite frankly, so did Richard Whittemore in the public consciousness. You know, once the Depression took hold and the Depression gangsters rose up, they could be seen on newsreels. There were talking pictures then. They could be talked about in between the movie reels. You know, you could see pictures of Bonnie and Clyde. You could see Dillinger. They had a presence that Richard and Margaret never really had because their crimes took place just before the era where you could actually see them move and where people could talk about
it. Yeah, before the talkies take hold. And
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, one point you make is that these two, the Whittemores, contribute why and how our society became obsessed with true crime. Did they lay the groundwork that others, Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde, built on? And what did they do to create this interest with true crime?
Yeah, well, I really think so. I think that in many ways, Richard is the archetypal gangster. You know, there were no movie gangsters in the silent films. And Margaret, in many ways, is the archetypal gun mole and femme fatale. It's funny because a lot of the tabloid journalists who covered the Whittemores, a guy named Mark Hellinger, for instance, a lot of these people later went on to Hollywood, where they wrote screenplays, where they produced films. Hellinger, in fact, produced and wrote the screenplay for The Roaring Twenties, which starred Humphrey Bogart and Jimmy Cagney. And when I watch these gangster films that were made in the 30s about the 1920s, there are echoes of Richard Whittemore and Margaret Whittemore in almost every film. I mean, the beautiful woman whose gangster boyfriend, you know, has a fine romance with and takes care of her. You know, that's something that's repeated over and over and over in films. And I really think a lot of it had to do with the tabloid press going to Hollywood and making use of parts of those stories in the films they ended up writing.
And one other thing, too, we've talked about why they were so beloved by the public, this couple. What do you think it says in society when certain criminals are held up and celebrated by huge groups of people? Is it indicate something's going on in society, that this is a problem and these people pushing back are some sort of answer to it? Or what do you think it says?
I think it speaks to inequities that exist in society, that's how and why people then identify with those people who aren't satisfied with the inequities, who try to do something, even something criminal, but they try to do something to escape a fate that seems almost inescapable and that is inescapable for almost everybody else. But if you're willing to, you know, to be utterly amoral, you can break those bounds that keep you confined. And I think that's what they see in Richard and Margaret. And I think that's what others see. You know, if you talk about Bonnie and Clyde, for instance, you know, they're operating during the Depression, where if you don't go out and get it, you're not going to survive. You're not going to get it. And people see that and they admire that somebody will just go out and try to take something and not be confined by what society says they're going to be.
Well, there is a lot more to the story. And for people who love true crime and getting into the details of how to commit a robbery and some of the larger implications, and this is safe to get into, listeners, because security systems have updated since the 1920s. So
yes, they have.
Sadly, you're not going to get
Don't try this at home.
Yeah, you're not going to get a lot of actionable crime intel from the Whittemores. You will get arrested, but not much else. So for people who want to check it out, the book is Tiger Girl and the Candy Kit. Glenn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Scott.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dan Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group. And here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.